We will start the meeting here. Introductions, I'm Eric Lima, SJ Engineering.
Ali Safai, Development Engineer.
Melissa Tracy, Development Engineer.
Steve Bacon, Clark Region Wastewater.
John Russo, Chicago Williams, NMY.
Andrew Gunther, PLS Engineering.
Mike Odrin, Olson Engineer.
Jeff Russon, Kings and Homes.
Don Hardy of WSP.
Ed Khan,
Pat Connie Packer.
And
Great, welcome everybody. Just for the record, the meetings are recorded and will be posted on the DEEP's website. Does anyone have any changes to the minutes or agenda?
No, I've reviewed and I don't see any changes that need to take place.
Anyone else?
We do have a change in the agenda. Matt Herman would like to have a few minutes to talk about the middle class agreement at the beginning of the meeting, if that's okay.
Good.
And I can give at some point a quick update of the final plot deal that came up.
Okay.
Where I'm thinking of going.
We can do that with member announcements.
Yeah, we can do that in member announcements. And then,
yeah.
So on the developer agreement, we could probably just add that as member announcements as well. That's all right.
Sure.
Unless it's a long update, is it a significant?
No, it's 15 minutes.
Okay. Well, we'll add that. Any opposition to that? Do we need to make a motion?
No.
Add it? No? Okay. So here and none, we'll consider the minutes and the agenda approved with the small change. So we are, any review upcoming events?
Yeah, actually it's going to be a very light schedule for both the board and also planning commission. The only item on the for the November is the public hearing for called supplemental that is on November 12th at 6 p.m. And also, I'm sorry, there is also TIP and the 2020 annual construction program and bridge load restrictions. Those are
2 days ago.
I didn't see the description of the 12 up there. Sorry about that. Yeah, November 12th doesn't say what the topic is.
In your reviews.
I'm going to do
changes.
That hearing, I'm sorry, is 10 a.m.
10 a.m.?
Yes.
Not 6 p.m.? Okay.
And also on the 12th, there's the continued hearing on the 12th agreement ordinance.
Yes.
Oh.
At the same time?
Yes.
Okay. That's for 192nd?
No.
No.
It's more on the procedures.
General.
Oh, on the procedures. Okay, developer agreement procedures. Okay.
Yes.
I know there's another work session that Don and I were asked to attend with biannual code changes.
That's a Carol.
Yeah.
I believe based on the email John sent this morning, it is in January.
Oh.
I thought it was sent in November to the 20th.
Yeah, he changed.
Oh, he did.
He gave us
okay.
List of the events from like planning commission to.
Okay.
So, yeah, he said he'd get back to us. There was an email that came.
There was.
That was not clear.
No, it wasn't clear to me either. So we have a pass then on the 20th. Okay.
Yeah, because okay. We had that on our schedule.
Yep.
And we got like after that work session, this was the initial.
Yep.
And then it looked like it was going to go through the process, and they're going to have their hearing on it. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds good. Is there something else in this planning? No? Chair, you want to take over? I'll fill in that for you.
Sure. You keep going and I can fill in the next, after the next thing.
All right, so we just finished upcoming events and our member announcements.
You want to go on final plat?
Sure.
So I reached out to the committee and we did get several comments back with concerns. What I've been trying to figure out is, you know, getting a big group back together, all that very unruly, doesn't really work for the sense of timing that I think we need on final plat. So I think JMA has already set up a meeting that I've asked for myself to be in attendance as well, to with Fidelity, to with Susan, I think, Mitch, hopefully Mitch, to talk about the issues that they're having with their plats. They run a large percentage. And then I was going to offer the same thing to Sherry, that we go in and just talk. And then between those two, I think, Sherry Hunsinger, I think between those two, we should hit all the issues. If they're not duplicated, we should hit all the issues, rather than bringing the whole group together and see what the county has to say, hear what, you know, and I'm just going to sit there as kind of a observer. But there was definitely, those that spoke up were definitely frustrated, yes.
That's the long email.
And not everyone spoke up, but those that did and others agreed, so it's always hard to get people to speak up. But.
All right. We'll look forward to getting an update after you guys have that meeting.
Yeah, and I think I should be able to get an update if we're doing a December meeting. Are we doing a December meeting? Okay. Yeah. The one is November 12th, and that's good. Just let Susan, whoever knows this. Maybe do another one with Sherry.
Mitch isn't on the invite right now, so I will have to see if he's available.
It's up to you who you want on the invite. I mean, it might be good for Mitch to be there. Just, he comes from the side of the mountains that I think their process is easier, but maybe not. This is what I've heard in terms of east of the mountains. They work with the same rules we do, so.
All right, thank you. Any other member announcements? Hearing none. So we added an item, we'll call it 1B, and that's the developer agreement update for Matt.
Let me fire up the screen real quick. So on October 3rd, the Development Engineering Advisory Board submitted a recommendation for development agreement procedures. It included several things that were forwarded onto your recommendation. After you made that recommendation, those recommendations were then sent to you in an email for verification. On October 8th, we held a work session with the council where these recommendations were introduced to them. They had a clarifying question regarding one of your recommendations, which was in regards to county-initiated development agreements. They wanted to basically find out what the intent of adding this language into the development agreement procedures was, and clarifying what a county-initiated development agreement would be. On November 5th, there was a hearing, public hearing, that went in front of council. It was Tuesday. Between that work session on October 8th and the November 5th public hearing, there wasn't a deep meeting. So they continued the hearing until next Tuesday, November 12th, where they want to receive your clarification regarding this language. So with that, I'd like to hear your thoughts and report back. From our prosecuting attorney's perspective, this is not something that a county-initiated development agreement would occur.
I'm sorry. A county-initiated development would not occur,
right?
Development agreement? It did. In Velvet Acres, the one of the subdivisions I did, where they asked us to voluntarily contribute some money to an intersection problem and work with Taylor or whatever, but it was county, as far as I'm concerned, it was county initiated. Taylor drafted it and ran it through, and we signed it, agreed to fund it. So,
well, this is something that several of us have consulted on, including Taylor, and
Yeah, I could have a one-off. I mean, I didn't initiate. Yeah, I didn't initiate giving the county money. They initiated asking me for money. So, and we didn't have a problem doing it, but it did take an agreement. Was county initiated.
Was the fairgrounds amphitheater, was that county initiated or not? I'm just curious as a in context.
I don't think so. I think that was more development.
Okay, just curious. I'm not really sure what this purpose of this is. I'm just asking a question.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just begging that question. I don't know what that would be.
So, was that an example?
The county fairgrounds amphitheater.
Oh, Velvet Acres. But it was a payment type of thing, voluntary payment type of thing. I don't know.
Exactly what it was. For what? For piece of property or what?
Well, no, there wasn't a problem. But anyway, there was a. You guys called it a loophole, but we didn't consider it a loophole. But in for Velvet Acres, you know, we're out by Money Gardens to get by the problem on So the county changed the TIFs. They moved things around, and then had the developers also contribute some money.
Well, that was. If I recall, there was a development agreement already in place. So that was an amendment to.
Was it?
Yes. That was an amendment to existing development agreement. Since I've been here, the county have not initiated a development agreement on our own that is not even associated to development. The one you're talking about was where it was amendment to an existing development agreement relating to Fitzman Creek, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Urban Mobile,
where we moved things around, parking pad fee, 500 was. It wasn't a county initiated, it was an amendment to an existing DEA.
Yeah, this one was related to concurrency issue. And an intersection, you know, deficiencies.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. But it was amendment to an existing agreement.
But it was an amendment to an agreement. Sure. I mean, if we have no county-initiated agreements, then we don't need that.
That's fine.
I think we were trying to think that if the county did initiate a development.
Why would they have to go through a preliminary procedure?
Yeah. It was trying to be helpful.
But we could regret it. Someday you might. I don't know.
Well, if there are none, then it doesn't hurt having it in there. But is there any scenario where the county would initiate a buffer?
I think the only thing I could think of is public-private partnerships. But that's way beyond, perhaps. That's years. I don't know what that is. But
yeah. Steve said he had a few examples. So I'm kind of curious, because the other one seemed like maybe that wasn't the best example.
That's most prominent that comes to my mind. But I know we have several other examples of I got John's from our office, you know, some of the things about planning stuff here. I know we have a couple of historic in the last 4 or 5 years, location on for location. I want to say stormwater facilities in a right of way that we didn't build. Just small ad hoc kinds of agreements. And the statute, development agreement statute, is very liberal in what it allows the county to do. This was my idea. I can't for the life of me imagine why the county would not want the ability to initiate a development agreement without going through the whole rest of the process.
Well, I'm not sure that the county, if the county would initiate a development agreement, it doesn't lack that ability by failure to have that language.
You're comfortable with that one too?
I mean, this doesn't say the county is authorized to initiate development agreements, and I'm not sure that it needs to.
To me, this is a no blood, no foul based on actual experience I had.
I think there may be some different perspectives and maybe a little kind of gray area on who initiated if this is the case. Maybe that's what the concern is. Because I was listening to Jeff's example, and in his opinion, it wasn't initiated by him, it was initiated by the county. But the reality is, and in turn, because I'm
that's right.
The only reason for the developer agreement is that you're proposing a project that needed an intersection.
This is a pre-agreed development before we came in.
Right.
Development agreement. I think Oliver's right. It was one of those.
Right, but if it wasn't, then it could still be a perspective where it didn't. You know, the only reason for the development agreement is because of the development. Otherwise, it's a different type of agreement. Right. So there's always two parties. And whether you initiate,
but that was a technicality.
Yeah.
In that it was it is a technicality, in that it was an amendment to the agreement. Mm-hmm. But it was really the county, Mark Bolt, you know, really that wanted, you know, us to put some skin in the game, and we were willing to do it voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to pay, you know, I'm not going to go through the process myself. So Taylor did it. And Taylor hounded us to get it done, and we signed it. And whether the other developers did or not, I don't know. But it put some money in, you know, the mm-hmm. county, you know, moved some things around, and then also voluntarily put some money in. We were done. I mean, it was a completely voluntary thing. Yeah.
No, I was going to add that it's an actual development that will trigger a development agreement depending on what the issues are. Typically, we don't develop property. So it comes from the development committee an application, and then we try to partner with the private sector to identify what the issues are before we even thinking of getting into a DA to resolve those issues. Because the county doesn't develop properly, so the county wouldn't be initiating a development agreement. That's the point that the council really was trying to clarify this language. That's my understanding. Because it's a project that triggers a DA. What are the issues, whether it's to mitigate to require intersection improvement, whatever the case may be, trip reservation, whatever it may be, it is a development that triggers that. That's where you negotiate and decide on how to resolve that through a DA. Otherwise, we will go out there just initiating a DA for the sake of it, or what?
Yeah. So in the case of this 179, for example, mm-hmm. when you have that, it's required. That's what the county has chosen to do to lift urban development through
yes.
a DA.
Yes.
It's not necessarily required to do a DA to lift urban development. The county could have funded the improvements themselves, and then it would open it up. So
yes.
the way I see it is, this is something that it's a joint cooperation between the development community and the county. So in this case, while it's not initiated by Clark County,
it wasn't.
It's not. It's initiated by the developer.
It was very much initiated.
Okay, just trying to make sure. From the developer's perspective, they might be saying, well, this is something that helps the county out because now we're helping to fund projects in advance. So I think that's maybe the confusion. What they're worried about is that it wouldn't be clear who actually initiated it. And
I think it's the concern that people are going to game this and try to have the, you know, in a public-private partnership type of thing, have the...
Trying to skirt the program,
yeah,
process.
By saying the county.
Yeah.
Well, but the county
is the one that started it.
They'd have, yeah. Well, they'd have to agree that they initiated it, but... I don't know, kind of like you were saying, public-private partnership, I don't know, you know, to whose benefit it is.
No, I
consider 179 a public-private partnership.
Yeah, but it was initiated.
Yeah.
But it was absolutely initiated by developers. I mean, both those things are true, and I think all the parties see benefits.
So, Chris, do you think you just said that's unnecessary?
I'm sorry?
You think this is completely unnecessary?
Well, you know, I'm not offended by it.
That's good.
Somebody trying to game the system.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
And maybe it is useful. I still have a hard time conceiving of the county initiated DA, and Steve, I'd be interested to look at those or look at one of them. but it may not hurt anything. You're right.
No, I think that's at this point. But.
No, and my best example again is the bonding proposed. That was totally came out of Chris's.
But was the bonding through a DA?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it sounds like it's a policy.
Well, do you know what the concern was?
They just wanted clarification. They didn't go into
DAC.
It's hard for us to determine what comment that's going to be
initiated.
Yeah, I think there's a...
They just want to know. They didn't have any particular concern about it.
They don't even want to know because historically we haven't initiated one. So when they saw the language and it came from D, they wanted a clarification.
I think we've uncovered the problem right here, too. From what Steve said, he thinks it's county.
Can I just clarify to address what Oliver just said?
Let me chime in here for a second because I have done. As a public agency, I have done DAs that we have initiated, and it's usually in a situation where we have the ability to tell a developer you need to fix this deficiency here before you can develop your property. We have an existing deficiency; it needs to be repaired. But in order to do the repair correctly, we have some other stuff that should be fixed as well. So we initiate a DA and say, if you will, with your contractor, fix this other or redo this other part of the system along with the part that you have to, we'll reimburse you for the cost of it type of thing. So we are initiating entering into a DA with a developer specifically for that. You know, they wouldn't need a DA for the piece that they're required to do anyways. So we want something additional done. We enter into a DA with somebody to get it done as a public-private partnership.
Are there preliminary review procedures followed in such a case when your agency initiated
the... We don't really have... I mean, our review process is going to be just looking at the plans anyways on most of it. Because we don't have land use authority, so there's not a whole lot to do in terms of preliminary stuff when the developers are, you know, in the process of getting final plans approved with the county. That's when we start seeing it. But it's just, I mean, we do have occasion where we use a process like this where it's, you know, they aren't required to pay additional fees or, you know, we're not collecting additional plan review fees or anything like that for these parts that we're doing. There's no, you know, we're trying to figure out a way to make the overall project the right project rather than just fixing a small piece of it that we can actually require them to do. So
the way DAs get used in a lot of jurisdictions, including the volume issues, when state statute authorizes something, but there isn't local code, so it's like, we can do this, we just don't have a code for it. I've never heard that before. So what the DA says is, it allows us to do is adhere to the state statute without having to go through a whole code process. It's a one-off. It's legal. There's nothing creating the system about it. But that's where the jurisdiction can introduce the development agreement in a position where maybe they don't have a code in place. And the local authority, the commissioners, whatever, council, still has to sign the development agreement. But it just doesn't have to go through this whole review process, and theoretically the county's taking care of that by initiating it in the first place. So that's...
Okay, I got an idea, because in this one's a time.
Yeah.
It sounds like Steve's example is really good, and I can see a scenario where the county might say, you know, we're required to do front-end improvements to this spot, but we have this one missing one next door. We would like you to do that. That, I think, would be initiated by the county in that case, because it's not triggered by their development, it's off-site, and there could be some value. However, there's a lot of confusion in this language. So maybe what we do is we bring this back to the conference saying, there's a scenario out there where the county, it might be in their best interest to request additional information from a development that wouldn't normally be required, that would be initiated by the county. And in that case, maybe we change this language to be a little softer where it's not as confusing. Instead of saying,
that development agreements that are initiated by Clark County are exempt from preliminary review procedures. We say that the procedures required by this section may be waived if the development agreement is initiated by Clark County. It's basically the first steps are kind of asking if the county is okay with it. I think the intent was that if the county is asking the developer to do it, they already know that they're okay with it. So it is redundant process. So, but that might not be the case each time. So changing the language to maybe waive from our exempt may stop
I would
it.
Say the council may waive.
The council may waive.
Right.
Okay. So does that work? And it kind of gives it, we could keep it out in there, and I think we did have some, you know, a reason for putting it in there. Mm-hmm. And I did like Steve's example, so maybe that solves it.
Okay.
Does that work?
Yeah, take a motion of that.
Okay. So,
good job.
Yeah.
Why don't you restate it, Eric?
Okay, so
moved.
We would change it to
second.
Instead of being exempt, that the councilors may waive the requirements.
Okay.
And also, I'd like to provide some detail for the councilors that there could be a situation where the county requires additional improvements beyond what the developer would be required to do. And this is an example. And the county is requesting it, and the method they're using is a deal. So
it's a toolbox issue.
It's a toolbox.
It really is.
I mean, yeah.
The MOUs used to be equally used back in the day. Those are no longer used as a tool. So I think the DA is kind of that.
So Mike made a motion. I seconded.
Ted?
Any additional discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank motion you. Passes? And I'm going to turn this back over to Terry now.
Sure, now that you really let it off the rails.
Permit center update.
So, thank you.
What up, Mike?
I'm not really sure.
Thank you, Matt.
One is an update. I never really got much information except you guys have some questions for me. So it's just going to be a real quick update of what's going on, like our workload and all that right now. And you guys have questions or specific questions that you want.
Yeah. Do you want to come up here so then?
Not really.
I'm just saying for the microphone. Now you're here.
Yeah.
So just some numbers that I ran real quick, just to kind of give you our workload that can kind of compare it from last year. Keep in mind, too, I am 4 staff members down, and we do have increased workload. So there is a reason why we are behind and a little backed up on our reviews. To date, just in October, from October last year, we had 1,605 people come through our door in the month. And to date, today for October, we had 2,006.
Wow.
We've got 4 less staff to deal with that traffic. We are actually only down 30 total permits from last year, too. And by the time we get up to the January 1, we will have passed the permit intake and issue that we had last year. And again, for this whole entire year, I've been 4 staff down.
For the entire year?
Pretty much. I lost a couple of my staff and 1 staff to another department here, so it's been quite a while.
Wow.
And it's been a painful process to hire. We're still struggling with lien. I know I think that's been a big topic on everybody as far as our lien process goes.
What's the struggle there? Is it abuse?
It is incomplete applications.
Just the same?
Same thing.
Incomplete, or
there's items that are incomplete. One of our biggest struggles is with stormwater, because the applications coming in for stormwater don't match the as-built that we have, and so then we've got to try to either rework it or work with all these groups to try to solve the problem. And then that kind of backs up a lien, so it's just been a real struggle getting them through. I have been working with the BIA and kind of getting our permit application process streamlined a little bit, so they're helping me with what they see as issues, and I'm telling them what we see as issues as well to try to get this a little more smooth process for everybody. Recently, we stopped having permit applications come in at 2:30. People can still come in, ask questions, and various other, and pick up permits, but no more permit applications, because we were not getting people out of our office until 5 o'clock, and we close at 3. It really hasn't helped. because people now just load up at 2:30. So I'm still not able to get to my reviews in the back room because we've still got people in the lobby. So it's just kind of a work in progress, trying to figure out what we can and can't do to get stuff out the door quicker. Besides me being able to staff up and get trained people. So,
can you talk about your staffing issue? I've heard it's taken you a very long time. It's been frustrating to get staff. Is that part of the county process, the labor pool, both?
It's part of the county process. I think last time I was able to hire a permit tech, I was able to promote one of my office assistants to a permit tech position. My pool that I had to choose from, there was not one previous permit tech in that pool. Oh. It was truck drivers, taxi cab drivers, stuff like that. So the labor pool is not all that good either.
Yeah.
But for us trying to hire, it takes probably 3 to 4 months to hire one person.
That's what I hear.
So it's a struggle.
Do you know,
inefficient?
I don't want to put you on the spot, but why? It takes 3 to 4 months?
We have certain hoops we have to go through to get the process going.
So I think even if you didn't have some of the process, it's probably a couple month process. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's a long process.
Yeah.
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 I can say I had the pleasure of sitting on one of their interview panels.
So have I. A couple of them.
Yeah.
We've all been there.
We've all been there.
it's a struggle for all our departments. I mean, it really is to try to get somebody hired because the process takes so long and we just get further behind the longer the process takes.
What about wait times?
Yeah.
Our wait times are down because that was our big focus with the whole CityGate report and everything else that came out. They want us to focus on wait times. So our wait times are down, but now our review times are up. So there's got to be a balance somewhere in there that we're trying to find.
From personal experience, now I'm in there. Whenever I have something to submit, I'm in there first thing in the morning at 8 o'clock. I've had very good experiences. They're right. In fact, they're like, don't even bother a ticket. Come on over. I'm ready to go. They seem to be fairly efficient. They seem to be picking up on the LMS process. Yep. And if they don't know, I came in with one that they're like, how do I do this? They figured it out. They knew who to call. That resource was available to help. So just from a personal experience, and that's where I was really pushing on the wait times was because I can't afford to sit in the permit center for 2 hours.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it's less the wait times right now, and it's the permit that are.
So you can get them in. It's just now processing them once they're processed.
And that's what we're trying to find a sweet spot for all this to do both. Because once we have a full lobby, then I've got to pull other people up front, which now they can't do the reviews in the back. So I'm trying to clear out the lobby. So it's just kind of a juggling act, trying to keep things moving along.
So without understanding what. Let's say it takes 2 months. What is it a matter of you have, and in most examples, you have an employee that's leaving to take a job somewhere else? And in that instance, then, do you have to go through a process to establish you need to hire someone to replace them? Is that what's happening? Or?
Yeah, so basically, we do vacancy reviews now with all our positions that we have open. So it's got to be approved before we can go ahead and hire. And then it's just and then with the whole Workday system, it's a process getting it in there, getting it posted, and it's just a longer process.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. So, if you're replacing someone that left, is there a way that could simplify that you can it lets you lose to be able to then hire that person if someone's left? I'm just wondering if there's something to help you out in that regard.
I would hope so.
But could suggest.
Yeah.
I think you're scratching a part of the problem from what I've heard. Cause I know that.
It seems like that's kind of the low-hanging fruit of. If they're hiring a new position and you need to vet that out, but if you're replacing someone who left, then there should be an expedited. Hey, yes, go.
Well, I think it's a personnel and human resources issue, also, right?
It's county government. It's government.
Yeah, but we can't. Accept.
Well, not to blame them. They have totally different standards.
Right.
To meet
no,
the private as well. And it should be that way. It just takes time.
But I think part of the problem is that you're a training ground, too. I mean, you're low-hanging fruit to pick people from,
to pick off,
to move up. But you're a critical part, I mean, an extremely critical part. Because I don't know, permits are taking 8 weeks or something like that?
Yep.
I mean, that's we're sitting on permit. That's a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess I'm just wondering if there's a way on the internal, what you can control on the internal side that isn't a right. standard delay that would be required because it's a government agency that could be shrunk.
The way we do it anyways is just every year our board adopts the organizational chart. It has all the positions listed on it. If one of those takes a job somewhere else, staff has full authority right there to just advertise and hire. So having to go through a review on an existing position that left without some, in a slowdown, if the economy were to slow down and demand goes south, then our board will say, no, we need to look at whether we actually need to rehire that, but that's on a one-off, not a consistent basis. It's a simple, yes, that's a funded position based on budget, hire somebody to refill it. So I guess I'm a little...
So could we make a... So I guess what... You know, I guess maybe Mitch, would it be helpful to make a recommendation?
I'm hoping you'll hold that until after I finish my presentation.
Okay. We will. Okay, so we'll table that conversation. Okay.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Understood.
We're going to talk about the business.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, Mike. We just occasionally we get updates as far as how the center is going. Jeff mentioned, hey, we haven't heard about that for a while, so that's why you're here today.
Good.
So thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. That's it. That's the firing line. Next, site distance details.
See, I'm a judge with Traffic Bell County. I was asked to be here because I understand you have some concerns regarding the way it is. The sketch you have in front of you has been the standard for 20 years, maybe more than 5. And we recently had put it in graphic form because we have a hard time understanding what it is. But when I review the developments coming in, There are inconsistencies with how the site distance is measured. And I understand you had some earlier discussion on this. So I did talk to a number of agencies, you know, City of Vancouver, which you have in front of you a copy of, and they have the same standard as we do. But although they have a little bit stringent standard, they follow ACTRL, which is slightly stricter than what we have. But it's the same 15 feet. I asked City of, let's see, Battleground, they have the same standard. I asked Washington County, they have the same standard. I think, was it Hillsborough? They have the same standard, 15 feet back. So I was not sure what your concern was. Or
I think the person brought it up, Seth brought it up. I think from looking at these details, this on the surface seems correct. However, the big inconsistency is traveled way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say curb, it doesn't say edge of pavement, it says traveled way.
Yeah.
And I think the question was, what's the proper way to determine a traveled way in different scenarios? And because it's unlikely that someone's going to be driving right along the curb.
Yes.
Especially when there's cars parked on one side or something like that. The question was, I think, that the hardest stance is, unless there's a strike, we don't know.
But
I don't know that that's appropriate. And then that ends up adding, it affects other parts of the development where, you know, site distance comes through, it affects driveways. It comes to the same thing that we had problems with that we resolved years ago on some of the other site distance stuff. And I've still got this package here in case anything came up on my notes from that process. So quite a few meetings, surveys, and, you know, all that stuff. So it came back to that same thing. Now, the way that this traveled way was being interpreted. And I think we came up with a proposal, maybe. We had a discussion, but then we wanted to bring it back. It wasn't necessarily on the agenda. So that's, I think,
okay.
That's it. The details aren't wrong. It's the definition of traveled way.
And that's interpreted. I believe under state law back or RCW, it defines where vehicles can ordinarily travel. And, you know, if you have a road width that's, you know, 28 feet or 36 feet, and if there is no strike, then they can travel against the curve. Especially you have, if you have local access road, the way it is you have 28 feet wide, and vehicles can park on either side or both sides of the road. So if you have, you know, vehicles parked on one side of the road, they would migrate towards the other, meaning travel closer to the curve. And that makes it the travel. Then you have situations where you have half of the street, either 20 feet or 24 feet, and then, you know, in that case, vehicles would travel next to the curve. What would be the situation where you have only 20 feet of road? And then you are measuring side distance. You don't know when that's going to improve.
Yeah, when you have 20 feet, you can assume the whole thing is traveled with.
Yes.
Yeah, when you have additional, or you have 28, 32, something like that, where there's actual buffer and shoulder and kind of straddling in there, then it may not be appropriate to measure it from the curb or the sidewalk. You may have unintended consequences where it does affect, you know, corner sight. And again, it comes down to this balancing competing interests. It's not just safety, it's balancing competing interests. And when you look at, as we're getting more dense, this is the same discussion we had before, there's trade-offs. And it's a policy decision on how to do that. We have to make sure it's safe, primary responsibility. But is it really likely in those situations where a car is going to be traveling right on the curb line? And I mean, most of the time they're traveling more towards the center. When you look at your detail, there's a travel line shown, and then there's parking on one side or two sides.
Yes, and that's what I was saying is, if you have, let's say, a local access road 28 feet wide, and there is vehicle parked, let's say, on the north side of the road, and then vehicles, you have this 28 minus 8, 20 feet remaining, so that vehicle would be traveling more towards the south side of the road. What would be the case in that case? So even worse, what if you said, okay, we will measure it, you know, I'm just giving an example, so let's say 8 feet, and then 8 minus 15, 7 feet, so you go 7 feet back, and county court says there can be no offenses, structures, others. Now you have a fixed object, a fixed translucent or opaque object there. Now people have to come all the way up, and now people are traveling right against the curb. And I can't tell you how many times I've received these kinds of customer service calls. People say, we don't have side distance. When I go and look at it, yeah, you measure 15 feet back and you do have people stop way back forward. In fact, a watchdog requires 18 feet back. And actually, I didn't print all those pictures for you, but I have it here, and it shows, I can give you the page number, page 13-10-41 from the watchdog design manual. It shows 18 feet from the edge.
Is it Watchdog or Ashdog?
Watchdog.
What's Ashdog say? Do you know? It's the same.
I think Ashdog says 18 feet also.
It's 18?
Yeah. It's the same. We have the same kind of standard. So they have 12 feet and they're measuring 8 feet from there. So our standard is 4 feet from the plane, which is same. 8 minus 4 is 12.
They clearly are not showing it from the curve of the edge of pavement. Though. They're showing it from the fog. 8 feet from the fog line.
The fog, if there was a fog line, yes. If there's a bike lane.
What's the maximum legal width? 8
feet.
What is the typical width of a truck in that curve?
6 foot? 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6 and a half, somewhere around there.
So I'll say 6. Okay. So a vehicle, a pickup truck, 6 foot, is required to park within 1 foot of the curb by state law, right? Okay. So if we assume a 6 foot vehicle 1 foot off, that means on a 28 foot road we have 21 foot between where a vehicle is parked on one curb line but 21 foot of pavement, right? So why is it unreasonable to assume that if this is not regulated, it can occur anywhere that happens, it can occur at any time, that the center of the road is somewhere in that 21% or 21 foot that's left over? Looking for obvious participation.
Yeah, no.
Why
I think it's the intersection that's appropriate.
Okay. If it's a four-legged intersection, you get the exact same thing. Because all I do is I take out that T, and then they're letting that direction. So why is that on a 28-foot road? What's the inconsistency? I don't want to say downside, because the downside is you're affecting these local homes. There's definitely a downside. But what, given the 28-foot road, if somebody parked on one side, given that width, and the 21-foot that's left over paved surface, what is wrong from a technical perspective of saying the center of that road is pretty darn close to the remaining 21 feet?
How far does a vehicle have to be parked away from a stop sign?
20-foot from a stop sign, 30-foot from a crosswalk marked or not.
Okay.
State law.
Okay.
The other part of the state law.
Is there a sign?
No.
No.
Didn't know that.
What? Ask me a question again.
No, I just didn't know if they were signed. I didn't realize you had to be. Would you say 30-foot from a
30-foot from a crosswalk
mark to park?
I think that there would be 20 feet from crosswalk, 30 feet from stop sign.
I thought it was either or.
Either way, 30-foot from a stop sign.
In any event, if you could have a situation where this vehicle is relatively close to the curvature.
Correct.
Except for, I guess, the instance I put up is if we have smaller lots and our lots are averaging a width of, say, 36 feet, and then if I have 30-foot setback of parking from a corner, then that means I'm not going to have any cars parked along the sides of the road because I have a driveway that then comes in that a car can't park in front of. So really, then my setback of my parking is going to be about, you know, it's going to be like 36 feet-ish.
However, we do not require the development to put the parking. The driveway drops in as part of the development. So the driveway drops are put in when the houses come in. And so we don't regulate where those are in relationship to any other location on the road.
Except for corner lots, because it has to be the furthest point.
So, the lot's oriented this way. That driveway doesn't have anything to do with what's on the main street, does it?
Yeah, so in that instance, then you're that would be. I'm just saying it needs to be something that's considered.
Okay, so understand the flip side of that is we have a new part of the code that says you have small lots, there are conditions where a stop sign can be put in.
Yep.
So we're addressing part of the concern you're talking about already with the county code that's been adopted.
Okay.
So we're looking at the other part of it, which is another element that isn't adopted. So in My question back to the group is it reasonable to say that because the state law says a roadway is 20-foot width, so the law says that, it's 21-foot here, understand that a legal vehicle at 8 foot, 1 foot off the parking, 1 foot off the curb would be 9 foot, which would make this 19 feet. Is it unreasonable to say that if we look at that, that is where the center of the driveway is, whether it's striped or not. If it's not striped, excuse me.
Yes.
It is unreasonable.
No, it's reasonable.
Okay.
To assume what you've drawn.
Okay. And I believe that's what part of the concern is how we're interpreting this part. So I'm looking for anyone to shoot holes in this from a technical perspective. I'm not trying to be a jackass up here. I'm trying to look for ways to.
But what the concern is that using the curb line as the travel way, and even here where you've got a 21-foot width, with, you know, so we'll call it 10 and a half feet. The detail says the site distance triangle is measured 4 feet from center line, which means now you've got 6.5 feet from the beginning of the site distance triangle to the edge of the right-of-way, and the vehicle is only 6 feet wide, so you've got 4 feet, or 3 or 4 feet from the curb, even based on this.
That is based on a WASHTAR standard right here that says, you know, for your measure your vehicle feet from the curb. 4 feet from the travel line, or a center line.
From the center line, right. You're measuring the site distance triangle starting 4 feet from the center.
4 feet from there, and then, yeah. So
which puts the vehicle off.
So center of where the vehicle is traveling. And so if you are, what you are suggesting that bring it closer to the curb, not 4 feet from the center.
No, I and maybe I don't understand what the issue is, but my understanding is that the position of the county is that the vehicle is traveling on the curb, and that's where you have to start, is with a vehicle traveling on the curb. But in this situation, even by the detail, the vehicle is traveling with the center of the vehicle 4 feet from the the center line, which is not at the curb. You've got a couple of feet of play.
And that is being liberal. If you make it closer to the curb, your side distance standard becomes even more stringent.
Well, it's on the curb now, so it's a stringent as
a right?
And then that's
on the curb.
Yeah, it's on the curb. What you're saying is because once you have your driver, once you have your vehicle closer to the curb, your side distance, line of sight distance will become like this as compared to, you know, it's exaggerated, but, you know, it's compared to this. So you have your delta here. The farther you move away, the more liberal it becomes in terms of the side distance. So, but the issue question is, what Rob just described, if you have a vehicle park here, 28 feet traveling, then you have only 21 feet remaining. So vehicles are traveling along the edge of the curve. What would you do in a situation like that, where vehicles are parked on the north side?
So now, that's what I'm kind of saying, though, is that with this, your vehicle is traveling here with this distance.
That is correct.
At 4 feet.
That is the assumption when 20
feet. That puts it. No, that's with it at 21 feet left.
Yeah.
That's with this car parked there. This vehicle is still a couple of feet off the curb.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
So making the assumption that vehicle is traveling down here.
Now I get it. That is already built in the equation, and I can show you the watchdog standard. That is already built in the equation. That they're not assuming it's hugging the curb here. It is assuming that the engineering publications look at it already assumes a shy distance.
Well, and that's, I don't deal in this stuff, so I'm going by what I heard as the complaint here is that the county is taking the position that the vehicles travel at the curb rather than giving them a couple of feet away from the curb, and that creates a sight distance triangle that.
Okay, let me bring what
causes problems.
The edge of the curb is the edge of the traveled way. That doesn't necessarily mean when you have a 12-feet traveling, just saying, it doesn't mean that the wheel or the mirror of the vehicle passes the travel as a line. It is means it's somewhere there within that 12 feet. And so the edge of face of the curb is the edge of the travel lane. Or traveled way. I'm sorry. That's what it is. So when you're talking about high distance, that 15 feet is already built in the equation.
So, the other thing to think about is, let's put this at night. So, at night, you need to see what needs to come up, right? So, if the vehicle is, if you're measuring 4 foot off that thick center line, that 4 foot is going to be right about where you're going to see a headlight of a vehicle coming towards you on the driver's side. Does that make sense? Because vehicle has a width on it. And the headlight, if you're measuring from 4 foot from that imaginary center line, that's about where the one headlight's going to be. Plus or minus. Pretty close. Maybe it's 3.5 feet, whatever the case is. But that doesn't put the car all the way up against the curb. That still has it kind of centered in that lane with a little bit of shy distance.
Those parked cars that are, you know, allowed by code within that, they're inside that sight distance car. They can't be.
Yes.
Okay.
For sure.
So the real issue that we could run into is that we don't allow driveways inside of those trackers because someone can park on there, but they can park in the street too. So sometimes. So here's an example.
It's kind of like have your cake and eat it too.
Well, there's cars parked there.
So, car parks, hopefully they're not parking blocking the sidewalk. That is different than a car park there.
And that was different. Okay, so in this example here, here's your side distance triangle, I'm just going to draw it here. Okay, so it's right here.
and we're going to go right here too. Okay, so it's going to be in here. So we have a lot right here. It's a very narrow lot. It's right here. And they want to put a driveway right here. Okay. And that's the problem. Although, in that same triangle, there might be a car parked in there, but they're not allowed in the driveway. So I guess the point is, if cars can go in the safe distance triangle, why can't drivers go in there? Because it's the same situation.
Okay. Maybe the assumption is they can see through it, because there's windows in it, they can see under, you can see headlights.
I can answer that question. So if you look in the traffic control devices handbook from IT, so you look at it and what it says is, because it's residential streets, it's very low volume, and that's why it's assumed that people can see through the windows and all those kind of things. And I don't know, that may have been written before the box trucks was invented or something. So that, and even though it's not in the county code and if collector street, if I see that, even if parking is allowed, when I see that, you'll see in my comments, I restrict parking in the line of sight within where the sight is. And I'm working towards it, so it becomes a county code.
So part of the balance, part of the overall balance we're looking at is you're looking at how do you balance the financial aspects of everything that has to go to make a property feasible. Is that fair enough?
I think there's another part of that. GMA also requires a minimum density in some cases, too.
Right.
Zoning densities have to be met.
What we're looking at is, from a parking perspective, to deal with off-street parking, is that off-street parking is seen as being a benefit to the community because people have their garages full of stuff and they have their driveways and the basketball hoops. So what are they going to do? Or they have their boat parked in their driveway. People have the ability to park on the street. People also have friends that come over and they have to park somewhere. So we try to find a balance with having that on-street parking, understanding that if there's a safety problem, we can always remove it. But our first goal is to allow the on-street parking because it's a benefit to the community.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I guess maybe there's another way to skin this cat. If this is the easiest way to do it, it beats code. Maybe it's the interpretation of what can be in the sentence triangle. Because if it's a berm, a fence, you can't see through it at all. It's just like a problem. I don't deal with them. We have one in our neighborhood that is a bush. You can never see. You got to creep out of the intersection before you see it. It's always a deal. And you don't want that situation.
So the code already addresses that.
It does address that. Yeah.
Buildings, fences, landscaping, walls, berms, etc.
Yeah, it doesn't say, however, that site distance easement show kept clear of obstructions, including vegetation, but not limited to landscaping, fences, structures, and earth berms between the heights of blah, 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 blah. It doesn't say in there parked cars. In other parts of the code, actually allow parked cars in worse spots than on the driveway. So maybe it's an interpretation that if you have a driveway that is pushed to that intersection, then it doesn't limit where the driveway is located in there. It does the same thing. It's the same problem, just addressing it in a way.
So Eric,
we already have this situation.
Just a question. So what zones are problematic? I mean, are there some zones that are totally fine, like R10 and 7.5 and the 6 and
yes.
These are 6 and
R5,
4, 1,000 square foot lots. These are PUDs.
R15 and
more dense. R15 and more dense.
Yeah.
So we just kind of a work order to put in a bunch of stop signs in a neighborhood that was built in 2006 and R15.
Yeah.
Homes. Excuse me. The siding, the striping plan showed the clear side triangles, but the houses were built within the clear side triangles to maximize the backyards. So we found out about it, and now we're putting in stop signs to address the fact that houses were built within the clear side triangles.
And it shouldn't have been allowed back then, though.
So. Understood, but it happened.
If it can happen when it's already against the rules, then it's not an issue that is trying to be addressed in the current.
So this is the reason why I brought that up is because we've been pushing for having the clear sight triangle shown on the plat. And this is one of the reasons why we'd like to have it shown on the plat, because then the person who's issuing the building permit has something that says, oh, the house can't go here. Instead of having this build somehow out of thin air, they have to go to a set of site and striping plans and get in front of them.
Again, though, that's not, I mean, I understand it's an issue, and I don't, actually, I don't know why people would argue against showing it on the plat.
Well, it depends on what the extension is.
The issue that we're talking about is the idea of you've got certain county ordinances, rules, whatever, that say this is the zoning, you have to have these, but then you've got this site distance issue that makes it almost impossible to put a driveway on those lots. So you've got competing county codes that say you have to have this density, which creates these narrow lots, because the lot, I mean, that's what the zoning ordinances do. And then you've got this site distance issue that creates a situation where, yes, you now have a lot that you can plat, but you can't put a building on it because you can't have a sidewalk or a driveway to that lot because it's in the site distance, right?
So part of that was addressed when the county modified the county code a year ago to allow for stop signs under certain circumstances to be something that was put in. And as far as I know, we're doing that. So I've signed a number of approvals for that.
Unfortunately, that this is the driveway being inside this stuff that now seems to be cannot show the piece on the flat. The reason just not shows the
one. And that should have an answer, right?
So clearly,
what we're hoping eventually is we're all going to agree it makes sense to put it on the list, and we'll do that.
Especially with the new stuff. And kind of just background, because we did go through this before. When we did an exercise before, the minimum lot that you could actually build with this old site distance triangle thing, you look at 80 feet, okay, with uncontrolled, was 58 feet. A lot had to be 58 feet. So when you have zones that are requiring 20 foot, 30 foot wide lots, 40 foot wide lots, it didn't work. And the trade-off was, we already did this, I don't rehash it. So in these smaller zones, you can put in stop signs because this isn't practical. It's competing and it balances competing interests.
Understood. So I'm not arguing the county code. I'm not arguing that.
That is a situation you're talking about, though, where buildings were built inside it, because they were built inside these things that didn't work, make sense to begin with. If it was done today, stop signs would have been put in right away. And then the buildings would have been pushed up and the competing interests would be balanced.
So question for you, do you think that we should show those site distances but allow the driveway to be there?
Yes.
Yeah, because right now we are struggling with this because there are consultants who don't want to show it on the plan. And just because they don't show me, then the building does not see those easements, and buildings are going in there, which is permanent, you can never change it. Just in case the stop sign doesn't work at one point, even if you put the stop sign, you got a building there.
No, I'm with you. I think they should be on the plan.
Right.
And people might disagree, but in that case, the clarification needs to be what are the instructions that are not allowed in this, and then there has to be that note on there.
Right.
And it should probably exclude the driveway. So you can already park a car in this triangle. Why can't you park the parked car in the driveway? Instead of even park it in a worse area that blocks site distance even more, further into it. So if we exclude the driveway, then I can problem solve. What do you think?
Yeah.
I agree with that, and I think that's where the resistance to put it on the plat was when we were proposing a stop sign, and there was a case where they also wanted the uncontrolled site distance easement shown, and we thought, you know, if you're putting a stop sign in, there isn't a reason to have both on there. And that's where we were, you know, said, hey, this seems like it's a bit excessive. I think the county stance was maybe the discussion that, well, in the future, it might be that the stop sign is removed. But it's kind of we're trying to make it work to be able to put the stop signs, you know, to serve these corner lots. And in that case, it's a townhome development. So once you have the stop signs, there shouldn't be a reason why you can't build within the uncontrolled site distance, because the other site distance triangle doesn't really impact the building. The front setback sets it far.
That's an example that was taken.
And there's also another. What he said, the townhomes, I started thinking about how some of the townhomes have the driveways in front, some of the townhomes have an alley in the back way. And so you have a different situation with townhomes. Different types of townhomes have different situations where you may or may not have
But is the alley considered an intersection? You've got the same exact problem on the back side if you're going to consider the alley an intersection.
So I think let me put on the bureaucratic hat. I know I've probably already done that way too many times since I've been up here. But as the state law goes, if you're exiting an alley onto the public right-of-way, you are required by law to stop for the sidewalk to make sure that no one's in the sidewalk, just like you are in a driveway. and then you can yield to the traffic in the street. So whether there's a stop sign or not on an alleyway, the state law covers the fact that you're supposed to stop and yield before entering into the public road.
I just want to mention that I just pulled up one of the plats we did last year, and we do show site distance easements on the plat.
It's inconsistent with what we see. I know some of the developers, engineers do it, some of them don't.
Yeah. You guys say put it on there? Put it on there.
Yeah.
It comes out of that.
Yeah, Sid doesn't know.
Well, I think it's good if the site distance is shown on the plat. But if it's something where we're unable to install a driveway within that,
I agree.
That's where the issue arises.
Right.
You cannot,
I agree. And that was the whole issue.
That's
the
interpretation problem.
Yep. Here was the issue of not being able to put a surface improvement that doesn't go above ground in the site distance.
For a long time, we were not worried about driveways. We were thinking fixed objects only. For a long time, until you know these discussions came up, you know, about the right things, you know, and because I think we made it more
because that was the interpretation. So it was never interpreted where a driveway couldn't be in the size of a triangle. Then all of a sudden it was enforced where it was.
Right.
That's what brought up.
Now we have gates
in there. And then we need a solution here.
Does the county code specifically say driveways in the cul-de-sac triangle?
No. No, there was. Now it is.
But it does after currently say that?
After we change it, yeah.
So it does currently say that?
Oh, yeah, now it does. Maybe, hold on.
You came up with the language.
Corner drive.
We completely agree with Eric's initial determination. We're good.
It was already in there. The corner driveways.
The corner
driveways.
That means the site distance reading.
Yeah,
there was no site distance language in it.
Yeah.
There were two sections of the code. One had to do with corner clears, one side. We put it together and we made a mess out of it. I truly believe that. We are doing fine before that. And we can ask people.
Well, the reason why we came here, though, was because those two codes were already mixed in the staff's head. That's why we got there. So to be
right. No.
We attempted to fix because they were assuming that driveways were a fixed object and they were treating them like fixed objects. So we changed the code to change the driveways to make it more reasonable. Based on that assumption. So if that assumption is not something that we should be assuming, then it changes the variable.
Bottom line is, it's not an issue of the buildings. Like, everyone, I think, is on the same page of the buildings have to stay out of the site distances. What I want, I guess, be clear is there any contention to, if the driveway and a parked vehicle is within that site distance triangle, do we have a problem? That's what it sounds like is the only issue that really is potentially not agreeing to, and I don't. Is there an issue with driveways in the site distance that you perceive and a parked vehicle? That's my question.
I think the driveways can be in those site distance triangles. And then looking back to the old code, because it used to be that they just had to be 5 feet off the property line. And then there was an interpretation made that as long as they're outside the site distance triangle, and that was added in the code.
Yeah.
And that's what caused the problem.
Right.
So then we had to mix this stuff and say,
to try and fix it.
Stop signs in, we did all this other stuff to address that concern, which shouldn't have ever happened.
What's the building setback? Front building.
10 feet to the house, 18 feet to the,
to the
garage.
But in no
so we're making the assumption that people are parking two cars in their driveway, or they're always going to park all the way out to the sidewalk? I mean,
usually don't.
It's
4 or 5 feet.
I guess I'm just wondering, is this just a situation where for some reason we're taking the worst possible case and applying that to every situation just because it can happen? I mean, it can happen that somebody, I'm a runner. I routinely am, whack my knees on trailer hitches because they've got a F-350 with an extended cab parked in a...
Hitting my...
it's one of those, you don't see it that often. And on a corner lot, you're taking a situation that doesn't happen that often, and you're applying it to every corner lot like it's going to be an everyday occurrence. Is that the situation that we're running into, where it's just, rather than saying people are going to park up next to their garage and we're going to have one-offs that give themselves a lot of space, we're going to assume that those one-offs are always, or the thing that's going to always happen. So a driveway means there's going to be a car parked in the site distance triangle all the time.
I have two road mods that came to me on my desk. They are asking for, having a little bit of the driving in the site distance, because they never asked for a stop sign, because they were older development. I think I'm going to approve them.
Is that an extra process that's not needed?
Right, and yeah, that's...
I'm asking for them to 20 foot driveway as far from the intersection as possible.
Right.
I
have another one of those coming too.
So,
to be clear, our question that we're trying to clarify is, if we have driveways that allow vehicles to be parked in them within the site distance triangle, but that's allowed.
What's that? But no buildings. Yeah.
But no buildings.
No buildings.
Everyone's on the same page.
That's a great improvement. Yeah.
Everyone's great with that. Okay. Then we can. What's the action item that we provide that helps to?
So I think the caveat to that is we would ask that the driveway should be as far away from the intersection.
Sure,
that makes sense.
Agreed.
That used to happen.
100% agree.
5 feet off the property.
100%.
5 feet off the property line.
Far to the away as possible.
Yep.
And not limited to the width. Here's the other. Okay. All this stuff's coming back. The problem was it limited the width to make it so you couldn't have a 3-car garage in any of those lots. So then you had this necking down, and so it was neck down to this really small driveway, which was another problem. But if we don't care about the driveways in the site distance triangle, then we don't have an issue.
We hold it as far to the...
Yeah, as far as we can.
But far away from the intersection as possible.
Yeah,
which is 5 feet.
You still need 5 feet, so your wing is not in front of somebody's lawn.
Without...
Okay,
so
with that said, do we want to make a recommendation of language?
We need to fix the code section and it exempts them and make it really clear that driveways are exempt from this site distance thing. Then we have to fix the code language in the section 4350.030.
So if we're going to move forward, you
need to re-separate the corner lot from the rest of them.
So if we're going to move forward on changing the code, I would ask that whatever changes we're going to incorporate into the code or consider change, that we have a way to agree upon how we're going to measure it so that we're not arguing about that anymore. We just come to consensus and that's what we're going to do. So if we can move forward with both at the same time, that may be something we can accept.
Can the code amendment be supported with an actual drawn detail?
Well, the details are in the standard plan, so yes.
So the standard plans have to be amended.
And that's a more of a something that we do from a...
That's preferred, I think.
We could even add the driveway in here to show that driveways are exempt.
Put a note on
there. I would suggest we not try to cross the streams, because if the code changes again, then we're going to have to make sure everything catches up. If anything, what we would do in the standard plans, we would refer to the section of the code so that we're not putting anything extra on the plans than we have to, but we point the user to the code that helps for what the current understanding is.
So 5 feet, but any limitation on width?
To be clear, there are zonings that allow that are 4 foot side yard setbacks, so I don't know if you want to change that, not to say five, but to the edge of the building setback.
Yeah, the reason for the 5 feet is from 6 inches to zero, really 5 feet.
Okay, that's common in most jurisdictions.
So would it be okay if we also added to the code that the clear site triangles are shown on the plat?
Yep.
So everyone's got the same playing field.
Yeah. I think the one pushback you may get is the process of a plow. So what's the scenario where you add a stop sign and it changes that distance triangle, but now you've got a very costly process to do a plow? Is there a way to do it where we put a note on there that these are shown based on the current traffic condition or traffic control and may vary if traffic control changes? Can we add that on there with the little site distance triangle?
Well, hopefully when we do the when you actually put the subdivision in, we're going to be putting in the stop signs that are appropriate or uncontrolled locations that are appropriate.
Yeah, and the problem didn't happen in the past, and things can change.
Mm-hmm.
And that interpretation that driveways couldn't be in the site distance is really the thing that...
Right, yeah. But if you're changing code to allow driveways to go in there, does it really matter on the platting with the site distance triangles anyway?
No,
you're not putting buildings there anyways.
No.
Yeah,
so,
did
you have anything else?
No,
so the one thing I want to be sure we're real clear about this, before we can go through and say yes, we can do this, we need to run it through our legal counsel and risk management to make sure that they're not seeing anything that's really a problem with changing that code.
Okay. Did you have any
examples? Just kidding.
Wow.
The whole thing that started the discussion with this and the 15 feet back from basic curve, you know, from the traveled way, was because in a standard 90 degree intersection, stop control, one direction, you still have part of the driveway in that site triangle, albeit a very little sliver. So that was where we were concerned that the county would still hold that no driveways are allowed within that site triangle.
So this would get rid of it.
Then I don't really have a concern.
Okay.
If the 15 feet is measured from basic curve or otherwise.
Okay.
Here's the line that it said caused the problem. It said we re-specified. I think all the stuff was good about where the drivers can go. Nothing has to change. We added up, there was a line added, and this actually came from staff because that was the policy at the time. And they added a line saying as long as the structure and parked cars in the driveway are outside the site distance triangle.
Yeah, the parked cars.
That wasn't something we wanted. That was something that was insisted by staff. So all we really have to do is strike that one line, and then create somewhere else saying that. The site distance, the driveways can be within that site distance, and I think we're okay.
So would maybe what's best
and
is
put on plow.
Would you want to come forward then after with the language like suggestion, and then we can.
Why don't we? Do you want to propose some language via email to the interested parties, and then that way he's got exactly what you're looking for. He can run that by risk management and legal counsel.
Yeah.
And then that way, if everything's on the up and up, then we can probably, and I think we're all in agreement here, so I don't even think we need to make a motion.
Let's come up with the language and what we want to put together as a group of information, bring it back, and make sure everyone comes to consensus. We don't have to agree. We have to come to consensus.
Yep.
And then if that's acceptable, we can see what we can move forward with.
Great.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if we can make it any more painful or convoluted, let me know.
Jake Field.
Okay. Sorry. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, you, Josh.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, we're running over.
I'll try and keep
Mitch,
it short.
Sorry.
Okay, so first off, I want to. The reason I'm here today is to tell you where we've landed after all the work we've done to evaluate our processes, to take a look at our time and motion, to look at our starting with the functional oversight team work we did, to re-engineer our permitting process, to identify the pinch points, to analyze our fee structure. We have evaluated ourselves silly. We have arrived at a point where we're going to need your help, and primarily because we have got to change the way we do business. Fundamentally, we are a business, and under the rules that we operate under, we are limited to recovering the cost of delivery of our service for permit activity. And that means that we can essentially charge only the cost only the fees that cover our cost to produce the product. And the product is the building permits, the land use permits, and so forth. in evaluating our operations, we've come to find that we are, in some instances, we are missing cost recovery goals by almost 200% in some instances, and maybe over. And that means that for every dollar of service that we're paid for, we're delivering $3 worth of service. And an example of that is we'll take a pre-application process the way it's currently structured. Right now, if you submit for a pre-application, you get the pre-application meeting, you take what was given to you back, you redraft it, you come back again, and you fail, you're given another opportunity for a free, no-cost pre-application. The problem is we're operating on 2009 fee basis. Our operational costs have increased incrementally year over year over year, and we've not raised our fees. So, as a result, the same level of service, which at the time in 2009 was set at 85% cost recovery, because they determined that 15% of our operations was to the good or to the benefit of the community. And those are things like impromptu meetings, phone calls, those types of things that give information to our customers, was a reasonable thing to do with our operations. And we could still meet our operational goals, pay the fees and the staff, and have a little bit of fund balance for business continuity in the event of a downturn. What has happened is that we have been not charging enough for the amount of service we're delivering. So we went back and evaluated the service delivery. Where is the pinch point? Why is it that we're not meeting that objective? If we get to collect a fee for service and our objective is delivering a permit, what happens to why we can't deliver that permit effectively and within the fee structure that we have in place? The challenge for us, the primary challenge, is the incomplete applications. Our continuous service to these applications over and over and over again, without charging additional fees, without recovering those costs. And that is what's gummed up the permitting process so badly. We have created such a huge volume of work that just hiring people and throwing them at it to complete the volume of work, we can't just continually increase our costs. What happens when we exceed the cost recovery, when we exceed the amount of money that we were paying for a permit application, by over-resourcing it, those costs are then borne by the general fund. The general fund subsidizes our operations. And when the general fund subsidizes our operations, if we can't deliver complete permit service within the fee amount that we were paid, we are reliant on the taxpayers of the county to pick up the difference. And that means that for the people that are really doing a great job of managing our permit process, and we have lots of good examples of people who sail through because they have it dialed in, they have their own process dialed in. They're working with customers that are robust customers, right? They have the means they need, they have their finances organized, they have their scope of work organized. All those things are done in advance. When they show up at our process, their application is complete, they save through, and there's a high probability they get passed on the first review. And its permits are issued conditionally. That needs to be our business model in every case, in every one of our major new construction permits, whether it's an addition to an existing structure or it's a new structure on vacant ground. That needs to be our model, because we can't make an argument to you or any of our customers that we need to increase fees if all we're doing is just increasing our resources without justifiably saying, what is it in our operations that's creating this need to add more resources? The reality is, if we look at the process and we minimize that process and we say, hey, what happens if we just do nothing but accept completed applications? We give the applicants complete crystal guidelines, roadmaps to successful applications. We get a completed application, and in exchange for that, we meet that 15-day turnaround that we promised through the functional oversight work that we did. And the permit is issued conditionally, and it's reliant on field verification for anything, because there's no big deal breakers in there. you're not having an inspector showing up on your site saying, hey, you still need a road bond, or I don't have this stormwater work, or I didn't get this habitat permit. Those things aren't happening any longer. And they're also not happening in the review process. The review, if we accept an incomplete application, we have to bounce it back to the applicant. Well, after we've completed that first review, we've pretty much exhausted that cost, the fee that we collect. And coming back to you time and time again saying, we need one more thing, and oh, by the way, we'll just wait till we hear from you, and we'll manage your permit application until then, doesn't do you a great service. Because what we could have done was say, in front of your application, is this is everything you're going to need. These are exact examples of foundation soils reports. This is what your wave permit looks like. Giving you and the applicant the best opportunity to look at examples of everything you need to complete your application successfully ensures there's a real high probability you'll get through our review process in the first round of reviews, and we'll be able to issue the permit condition on some minor changes. Minor changes, because they're not missing anything. That needs to be our business model. That is the basic business model for every successful high efficiency permit process in the United States. That's where we need to be. We can't get there though by just simply adding people to our agency and not commensurately looking at our process and finding ways to streamline it. So the question to you is, if we agree to change our operations to a single review format for everything that we can, and for to ensure that if for any reason an applicant can't make it through on the first pass, we have provisions in place for additional collection of additional fees when we've expended our cost recovery to monitor that very closely. So we have our checks and balances in place. We're looking at on a weekly basis, or even on an individual permit amount, we're able to look at the metrics and determine whether or not we're close to our cost recovery objective there. But to give you the opportunity in advance to sit down with your customers and really dial in the application process, saying, look, this is everything we're going to need for this specific site. If we need a more detailed analysis of the site, you would be welcome to join us here and pay for a fee. Pay to have staff set time aside to sit down with you and review your project in your company to walk you through that permit application process and identify the very things that you would need. Otherwise, you'd be limited to the information we provide to you online, at the counter in handouts, and through a call-in where we can do a live chat. But that's something that we're working on. What we need to hear from you is, what are the impacts on your business? What are the impacts on your operations? What are the impacts on your resources? What does this mean for you if you can't submit an incomplete application?
Yeah.
And this is homework, right? And I don't need answers right now. We've got a couple of weeks.
Couple of questions.
Sure.
Have been speaking, I believe, primarily for building permits. Does this also apply to land use?
So, yes.
Okay.
Engineering. And wetland and habitat.
Okay. That's out of your bailiwick, but we talked about engineering going through maybe two reviews, the meeting, and if you attend the meeting and do everything the meeting said, then away you go.
Yeah, that's truly the objective. But we found that in as the work we did with the functional oversight, we opened the door for people to take advantage of the opportunity to meet with us in advance and go through this. What we found was nobody was taking advantage of that, but they were looking at their processes. But we still have a lot of incomplete applications we're receiving that are ending up in the date bin, and we're also getting lien applications that don't necessarily meet that threshold that we need them to meet in order to meet our processing deadlines. So we got to find a way to basically turn all our land use applications and everything else into kind of a lien process. That's our good example.
Yeah.
We've got good examples in land use right now that we use every single day where applications just whistle through. And it's because people are spending that extra time up front to get it right on the front end.
Yeah. So when you talk about this, it's your 300% over what your cost recovery, 200% over what your cost recovery would be. Change that. It's a significant number. Is that across the board?
No. No, it's in some programs. Each program is different.
Okay. So, meaning some of these fly through.
Yes.
That eats up 100% out of the gate, right?
Pretty much.
Okay. There's no padding or anything right. To where you have very little. Okay. And so from a business standpoint, I don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, and you know, I don't want you to give away any trade secrets, but when we give a proposal to a client, we are estimating an amount of time that it's going to take us to do this. Now, we don't dial it down to, pardon the phrase, but down to an ass. We know that there's going to be some flexibility in there, that we're going to have some back and forth and whatever, but we also realize that, hey, we are very specific in our proposals and say, hey, this is for this. Anything over and above this that you want, it's an additional service. And if you're clear in your literature, in your proposal, say it's your proposal, say this is what this buys you. But if you fall outside of this box, it's an additional service, which means an additional fee.
That's what we have.
That's what we're trying to get to. I mean, the inspection part of it, they have that re-inspect fee after two or three times. We're doing the same thing downstairs now after two or three times. The biggest thing we're seeing, though, is on a just a normal house permit, say the fees that we get, roughly $3,100 out of all the fees you guys pay, that's what the county gets. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to the fifth inspection, maybe even the first inspection, with two or three, four or five different reviews, that money's gone.
Right.
So just a question on the 2009 baseline. I mean,
sure.
I see your cost recovery as an option. Is there an option to go back and recalibrate the fees overall collectively? I mean, that seems to be probably, I'm guessing that's a big part of that issue.
And that's probably a huge fee.
10 years. Well, it wouldn't be, but that would cover that issue. Yeah.
So to your point, that's an excellent, yes, there is. But only after we have developed our process to the nth degree.
Yeah.
It has to be as streamlined as possible for us to meet the state requirement for cost recovery. We cannot have unlimited cost recovery. That's not an option. The state is going to say you can't just continually charge people because they're failing in their application process. There's a finite end to that. And it comes in the form of a reasonable delivery of service. And because it's predicated on completed applications, which includes vesting because we're taking money, we want to make sure we're doing a really good job of getting that service back to you in that time frame. We also don't want to gum staff up with multiple reviews. Every time they can get a project out from underneath their to-do basket with only a single review, that means they can immediately get to the next application. So to Mike's point, if we've got, if we can process 7 lien applications a day, as an example, that's going to clear that in basket out of there in no time. You know, it's also going to clear out the date then, because then we get to take that extra capacity and move it toward that other work that needs to be done. What we're not going to do is have a bunch of incomplete applications in the date then waiting for response, or in the review process waiting for response from the applicant, because major aspects of their project are missing. And they tried to rush the application in the door to beat a deadline or to make a customer happy, and they're hoping upon hope that they can get that 16-week turnaround from point of permit to CO. And those are so many things that are outside our sphere of control. We really can't fix that for the industry.
I think... Sorry.
No, go ahead.
The process, building permit process specifically, has gotten most of it being by the state and what's required, has become very complex. And so I think it's also a matter of, I think you're what you mentioned about having someone that can be there to walk through that process with someone is instrumental to kind of help with smaller, say, builders that are coming through to try and do that. And what I've gathered is those that are not submitting as many permits, and the larger builders have their own permit tech, basically, that's providing these packages that have done them, 30 plus times, and so they're able to simplify that, but not everyone can afford a permit tech. And so then if you're providing that avenue, someone's going to pay more, which accordingly, because they're going to take more time, I think that makes great sense. And then with that too is the timing side is
I know then there's every, you know, you get people pushing into a lean process that maybe are not a good fit for it because of their lack of experience, but it's that it's a dramatic timing difference in review from lean to not lean, and so that's part of the conversation too.
Well, in regards to the larger builders that have done it so many times, we've one of our largest builders here in Clark County, we actually sat down with the lean process, went through the whole entire application process with them. The very next lean submittal, it was like they had never been in our office ever. So we're trying to simplify this for everybody and get everybody on the same page. And everybody that has to submit the same way will go through the exact same process.
Yeah.
And yes, we will help. We're not just going to kick you out because you're missing a dimension. Right. We'll write it in. You guys initial it. We're good to go. We just keep things moving along.
Okay.
It's those big items that just stop us. And we just can't.
Yes, stop.
That we can't move forward.
To your point, Terry, what, and this also, you know, to your point about communication, on the front end of this, organizationally, we have to change how we evaluate those applications on the front end. If we're doing that level of completeness and we're going to have to reject applications that are incomplete, we better be able to tell you exactly what it is you need to come back with.
Yeah.
So there's a high probability.
And it better be crystal clear
on
the...
With examples, pictures and arrows, 8x10 photographs.
Yeah.
So we are going to formulate a checklist for everybody that we're going to use and that you guys are going to use. And so when you go through this little process, whether you're missing one item on the very first time, we're still going to complete the whole entire process. So we give you back exactly what you need. So we're not going to stop and say, okay, you're out. Mm-hmm. We're going to complete the process. So you get all the information is going to be the first time. And we're going to continue following that same list over and over and over and over.
Once we have that in place, then we can make a very lucid argument for increases relative to the volume of business. When we see an uptick in the economy, and we see more development coming down the pipe, we can add more positions because we can justify it. It's not because there's there's more delay in the process. It's because there's more demand for that expedited service. And that's really what we want.
So there's more work that you guys are planning on doing before maybe coming back to us.
Well, we want to hear from you before we finalize the proposal, before we finalize the process. Because of the amount of operational changes and adjacencies that we would need, our front counter would look a little bit differently. The personnel down there would look different.
Mm-hmm.
And we're anticipating this because, again, we want to deliver that high level of service on the front end at the front door instead of waiting for the review process to start before you get it. So how we structure our organization on the front end is going to be dependent on the feedback we get from you.
Okay.
What we really like to know is, think about this, take this back with you for maybe a week or two, and then come back to us with some suggestions, with concerns, anything that you may think of in your process and from your customer's perspective that would make this difficult for them or would be supportive. Because I'd like to hear from you either way, you know, pro or con, and with ideas, you know, things that would make things easier for you. But also level the playing field so you're not competing and your good applications aren't impeded by the bad applicants.
We've had on our work list for Deeb, looking at it, particularly from a land use standpoint, the fully complete review process. I think this is a good time to do that. And I think, Susan, if you would be interested or willing to at least sit down with myself or have a telephone conversation about our concerns, how that's going, at least start that conversation, because you don't hear how it comes from our side. We don't really see what you guys send us a letter. It's either yay or nay. And I think we can at least start that conversation. I would be willing to do that with Susan if she has time to do that. From the land use standpoint, we can't speak to the building standpoint.
Yeah. Last thing I would like
to join that as well.
Okay.
Because I think there are some areas where Clark County could look more like Vancouver, I mean, in terms of that process.
Yes.
I mean, some things, and not to dive into the weeds because the hour is late, but there's some things that are not substantive that are holding up fully complete processes.
Yep.
That's the issue. I mean, they could be conditionally approved.
There's a lot of issues.
They could be conditionally approved. They're not substantive. There's a lot of that. The bar is really high to get through the process.
Agreed. Let's leave the land use part of that for today.
The land use aside, what
tolerance is there from the lien process before you pop into the date bed? In other words, I mean, because you make a few mistakes, you get put in the date bed.
No, so right now, if it's something that we can go ahead and write in and have you guys initial when you come back in, so like a dimension, an elevation, you're missing a corner of your property. I mean, something simple like that, we take care of that. We keep you in lien and we don't kick you out. If it's something that we just can't move forward at all on our own to keep that going in the process during the day and we have to wait for you guys to do something, that's when you guys are booted to the date bin.
How do you get yourself out of the date bin?
You don't.
That's
because we are so far, I mean, right now we're booked until, I want to say, December 12th for liens.
I mean, just from my standpoint, I'll go back and talk to, you know, I want us to be one of the ones doing it right, wrong, you know, doing it right. I don't know whether we're doing it right, wrong. I don't know if we're going through lien or going into the date bin. All I know is I'm hearing it's taking a hell of a long time.
Yeah.
If it's coming from our end, I want to fix it. So that, as a principal, I want to fix that.
So giving you that information up front?
Absolutely.
Really critical.
Well, absolutely. Or, you know, company by company or whatever. I mean, they're not, you know, we're still a small community when it comes to the amount of developers and home builders that are running, you know, a large percentage of what's going through the county.
Honestly,
we should be able to get it right.
Right.
I mean, it's tricky, and little mistakes happen. But
so the completed application, you know, what a completed application looks like for us, so, and to help you in your review, is everything that would otherwise cause us to delay your application, if we encountered it, is taken care of. That means if there's a shoreline permit you need, you have it. Yeah. If there's a wave permit you need, you have it. If there's a road mod you need, you have it. Those things all come in with the application for the building permit. All that stuff's been taken care of in advance. And there's no surprises for us in the application. It sails through because all the stuff that we would normally spend time holding up your application for is not there because it's been taken care of.
Okay.
But that's an investment. That's a pretty substantial investment. And if you're, you know, and I'm not speaking to anybody here, I know this, but if your business is working in the margins and you're on a shoestring, you're only building maybe, you know, 5 or 6 houses a year at most, and you've got customers who are demanding to be in on this date no matter what, and you're starting your application, you're telling them that, okay, as soon as I get the application submitted, you'll have your house in 16 weeks, and we'll hit that date, and you don't know what all's involved with that, meeting that obligation for a completed application, you're going to be going back to them with your hat in your hands and saying, you know what, they rejected my application because it wasn't complete. You can blame us for that. I'll die on my sword for that. Simply because it's the right thing to do. If the worst thing to do is what we've been doing, which is taking your applications in any form and then sitting on them and gumming up our works, because it gets in the way of it adds capacity that we don't have. It adds resourcing. It causes us to add resourcing that we don't need. The more streamlined our process, the better the argument we can make. And a structural change in our fee structure would basically only be limited to those things that the costs we're not covering through that streamlined process. If we looked at it right now, it would be this 200% fee increase. That's not where we want to land in this. That's not how you solve the problem.
Right, and I'm hoping with this, it'll kind of help out with that, because we've done a lot of research. I've looked at every jurisdiction in state of Washington, and we are the second to third lowest for permit fees, and I mean by far.
Yeah, we've seen that.
And that's just we're trying, it's not like we want to just all listen to, okay, 200%, you know, 200%, here you go. We just got to make little...
Conversely, though, in particularly land use, because they're taking the biggest hit, and wetland and habitat, if it's justified, because that's the amount of service you're getting, then the fee would be appropriate, even if it does increase by 200%.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's only going to be that fee, not the entirety of of every fee we have. So we need to dial that in. The other aspect of this we get is the monitoring, quality assurance, and quality control. And we get that in a dashboard so we can track it on each individual permit. And that gives us a modicum of control that we haven't enjoyed and we haven't been able to utilize in our business model.
Yeah.
And we really do need that. But I'm sorry I ran a little over, but I would really like to hear from you.
No, this is good.
You don't need to rush it. Predication is Single review accomplishes everything you need because we have a completed application.
Right.
But wanting to know the impacts on your operations and customers would be really beneficial for us as we finalize the proposal.
Yeah, we have to make it reasonable. Single review, sometimes once you get a comment, there's sometimes a discussion. So I think we have to set a reasonable expectation.
Yes, absolutely.
So a lot of great stuff. The stuff you said, I'm in line with almost all of it. A lot of that was good stuff that came out of the functional oversight.
Yes, it was.
And it's also like a few. Like this things, I know we're running late, so we need to make sure we're not making the processes more difficult than they need to be. So, for example, we still have to look at on our work session on these single family residences, the stormwater reviews are still taking a lot of time. They're going back to multiple reviews, and it's because we have a plan to fix it, we haven't had time to do it yet, and we need to make sure those are done because instead of raising the fee, we can cut back on the amount of effort to get the same result based on the risk. So, those things we need to do if we're going to raise the fees, we need to justify them with those things, and then also. Making sure you provide the right guidance, and you've hit on this over and over again, making sure that people know what it is. Because right now, especially in the rural SFRs, they had no idea what they were doing. And you were training every single person when they came in, and of course you're 3 times, 4 times over budget.
Yep.
I'm surprised you're not more on some of them. So if we have a process that they understand what's required, then hopefully it cuts down the cost. And that's part of this implementation, but we got to make sure that happens.
I'd like to have a draft proposal to circulate for everybody after we've heard from you by the end of this month.
Okay.
And as you know, we would love to be able to go live with a soft go live on December 1st, meaning there's a lot of work on the front end in the changing and structural change, and then give us at least a full quarter of the new process before we even think about fee changes. We really won't know. We can't dial in our fee changes until we know exactly
the time involved.
The time involved.
Yes.
And it is unfair to come back.
Are you proposing on going to contractors or BIA with this same discussion?
Yeah. So Sean Hennessy and I are scheduled at BIA on December 9th, which should be enough time to hear. That should be time for us to be able to have our proposal together.
Okay. And I've had a couple conversations with BIA already, so they're already aware of what we're trying to do.
Awesome.
Yeah, we have to be
doing those lunches, and I don't know what all you're doing, but I know you're doing.
Eric, you're their chairman of Governor's Affairs, right?
Yeah, I know I didn't have the exact date, but we talked about meeting with you guys at one of the company meetings. So I guess December 9th is
kind
of
great.
And then, the lunches have been very productive as well.
Yeah. We want to be successful, and we need your help to do it. If you want to be successful, we have our internal partners that we need to be good to. And that's mindful in the same way we're being mindful of your needs, mindful of our review needs, and having the time to make really well-informed decisions is optimal for us. So, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice. Appreciate it. Jeff, sorry to push you off.
I just promised Mike I'd only take like 3 minutes. So I'm gonna all I really have is essentially an announcement.
Thanks, guys.
Based.
Thank you.
A little bit of an update on our stormwater capital programming. I know you guys have been recently with the transportation program in. They're putting their 6-year plan through the council here shortly. We're going to be going to council on December 3rd is our projected date to get our current 6-year plan adopted. That's one reason that I wanted to announce that to you guys. In the past, or at least in the recent past, we haven't done a formal adoption of that 6-year plan for stormwater through the council. But at our work session with the council a few weeks ago, we decided that would be kind of a good thing to do again. It helps us when we apply for grants. Helps us to make sure that stormwater is kind of front and center, as well as the other things that are important county planning processes. So we're going to do that, meaning we're doing CEQA review. Wanted to come to this group and at least let you know that that's occurring. I can get some basic slides provided to you guys if you want to take a look at what we'll be showing, or what we've already showed and what we'll show again to the council, and or the actual document if you're interested in reviewing that. If there is an interest by this group to do so, I can give that to Allie and
can you come next month?
What's that?
Can you come next month with that?
Over the 3rd is when it's getting adopted, so that's our target date.
Yeah. Could you send the language updates that you're looking at? Where maybe Ali, you could send that to the group.
Sure.
Yep. So then that way it happens before, and if there's some sort of question or
comment. Everyone's got questions, comments, red flags, that kind of stuff. That's what I'd like to know
maybe
about
that'd
before
be
we get there.
Great. If you have slides, that's great. But I think specifically just seeing the language updates.
Perfect. Yep. Very similar to previous programs. We've got our priorities are always repairing things that we already own that are not working well. We've got UIC, underground injection control requirements, where we have some of those are completed in groundwater. We got to be decommissioning those. And then we're really focusing right now on two things. One is treatment retrofits in areas like Cougar Creek, Suds Creek, all these kind of lower Salmon Creek, super heavily developed a long time ago. There's very little stormwater control or treatment in those areas. So we're really trying to go back there and retrofit. And there's a few other things, but you know, those are kind of the big hitters in that plan. The other thing is we're hoping to be more this whole issue with the appeal of the growth management board's finding that we were out of compliance with the GMA at the county. That getting closer to resolution means that we're hopeful that grant applications will be something we can do again by next year. So we're front loading a lot of design work. So we want to get a lot of these projects to like a 60% design so that we can go forward and try to make up some lost ground on getting grant monies in. The overall project list, we've got 27 projects in the plan for the 6-year. Total cost is just under $14 million, $14.8, something like that. So we're averaging around a little bit over $2 million a year, which is around the long-term average for what we spend on our stormwater program. So, that's kind of got a little pie chart and stuff like that you guys can take a peek at. That's about all I needed to say.
Cool.
So thanks.
Everyone good?
All right.
Thanks.
I'll get with you guys.
Great. Yep. Thank you.
Sweet.
Public comment?
Yeah, I'll be real quick. I brought this up with Susan, addressed it with Ryan, TIA, and frankly with Jamie. We would like to be able to pay impact fees at the time of a flat phase reporting. The county currently, the only time the county can collect an impact fee under county code is at the time of bill issuance of building permit or application of building permit. We're not talking about vesting of impact fees here. From our perspective, this is an equity, a builder equity issue, and how it's a legal issue. Since we recorded the first phase of Rivendell, we've had enormous increases in park impact fees. One of our projects now, my understanding, I'm not talking about the term, my understanding is one of our projects is going to be impacted on transportation impact fees because of the urban holdings bill. We could go out, we're about to record a phase in Rivendell. We would be prepared to go and submit building applications for every unit in that phase all on one day. If we could, county. We can't feed the county through fireworks like that. That's what just heard. So, from our position, equity kind of demands that the developer ought to have the option to be able to pay the impact fees for every unit in the phase as it records. Because at that point, these are impact mitigation fees. At that point, the impact is being created and should be mitigated at that point. Because you have to have a residential. I would think there'd be some potential advantages to both the county and the school districts, because as maybe if this had been in place, you know, several years ago during the crash, you know, they would have been actually had their money
during the short
up front. I think obviously it's a complicated policy, but I think it's something that we really ought to explore because it really would provide a lot more certainty to builders and developers, and probably provide some certainty to the people receiving the funds as well. So that's our proposal. We've asked. The only response back really is as a county commissioner or county council kind of policy decision. I would certainly like to encourage the deed to this is the first time I've spoken about it outside of our office, but I certainly think that there's some merit, especially in current housing situation that we have and the dramatic, you know. I appreciate that you said the building package, then we almost become one of the highest in the city. So that's my pitch. Hopefully, we can get some traction. So that makes a lot of sense.
Do you have any examples of where that it has worked and it's allowed?
Houston's Keelan Bambi right now, or he'd be able to tell you, but we use. We've done that process elsewhere in the state.
So did they have a process that they
got to? Yeah, there's nothing in state statute. State statute doesn't say when, in fact, fees are to be imposed. The building permit is usually one of the easiest.
It kind of seems reasonable, but on the county side, it could be an accounting nightmare. And they have to make sure that their system can handle it. I mean, trying to figure out which ones did have it, which ones didn't.
That's why you record it with a platinum, and you put it on platinum.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Impact fees for this development have been paid.
That's more of like a time mark entry, or whatever you guys call it now.
Steve and I talked about this back a little bit on email, and I think if it was something like you had to do the whole subdivision or not.
What's been your reception from staff thus far? Just that?
So I want to bring this to the industry first. This is not a novel thought, but there really is nothing legally.
And you said, did you say that this is done in other parts of the state?
Yeah.
Okay. Assuming like Tri-Cities maybe.
Yeah.
Do they have the option? Or do they require...
I don't know how it works. As I said, I wish you were here to speak.
Okay, we'd be interested because it is an option to do it either at the time of building permit or at the flat recording. All the accounting, I think, it's a flat note. These have been paid. Maybe it's a stamp. Maybe it's something, whatever it is. But then the accounting, you don't have to worry about it at all from this accounting standpoint. You guys deal with all of that if you happen to sell the lots off or whatever.
Well, think about the impact it would have on lot valuation. I mean, we build our own, but it becomes an investment in the property in a sense of you can sell. Let's say the market isn't quite as on fire, but you're selling lots, and now you can sell a lot as having to a builder, as having. So he doesn't have to factor in the impact fees.
More shovel ready.
Yeah, more shovel ready.
Now, are you thinking it's all impact fees, or just tips?
I think the proposal would be to pay all of them, but that would be a policy issue.
I think that the schools would need to want to chime in on that.
But like I said, if you just did it for tips to start.
Tips and PIFs are the easiest. The school one becomes more complex because you have an outside partner.
I think you want some food feedback. Obviously, you need feedback from the districts before you got into that. But I would speculate, being a school board member myself, that most districts right now that aren't growing, like Vancouver and Evergreen, would probably jump on that. Say, hey, look, right now, not most districts aren't going through the radical growth that they went through in the early 2000s. So a lot of school impact fees are tending to stabilize out a lot. So I would think. Districts are just getting their money up front.
It seems like to me an all or nothing approach would be something that's feasible process wise and tracking wise, but you'd have to get school impact as it relates to school impact fees. School input.
This is the first conversation. I think it's not inconceivable, and I think there's a lot of advantages to everybody.
Impact fees are meant to be planned. Yeah, I think that helps if that funding is there and they can plan even that much further forward. So, as far as
impact fees, phase four of Rivendell, why are they different when we record tomorrow than when we build a house in 6 months after activities going on. I mean, that's my point.
The trips are already contemplated within the model, and the impacts are already contemplated.
Yeah, I think that's there's a healthy argument for that.
For political literally for political reasons.
Because you're not locking in your building permit costs, which that will change, and that and then it's relative to the time.
The impact of the time it's been created.
Yeah. No, I think there's a good legal support for that. So.
Yeah, I don't think historically we've seen the kind of jumps we've seen recently with things like the school impact fees and the park impact fees. Those have been fairly significant.
I mean, what if they go down 8%?
So well, then that's on the developer.
Yeah, they lose.
It's like selling short, you know.
Right.
Be a voluntary program.
Yeah, you have to be voluntary. You just get to choose one. You either pay now or pay building permit.
Yeah, I can see where the option could be.
Okay, so did you just want feedback?
I think he's just getting the word out.
I think I'm just discussing right now as a pub court.
I will definitely go back and discuss this.
I got it freed up with Brian.
Thank you, sorry.
Ideas.
Cool. Okay, thank you. Thanks for everyone's patience.